Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. Hope everybody had a nice Yom Tov, inspiring Yom Tov, meaningful and good things. And we should have all blessed with a good year, Marka Timatova, to everybody. And should hear good things, personal, national, worldwide. Should be a year of happy occasions. Okay, pleasure to welcome back Dr. Mark. Is part two in our rejuvenated series, a few more weeks on the letters of the Rav. And we'll let you take it from here. Vakasha.
Okay. Hi, everyone. It's September 18th. Just finished a little while ago, Tzom Gedalia on the East Coast. And we're picking up, going through a number of letters in this volume, Community, Covenant, and Commitment. Selectors and Communications. Rabbi Joseph B. Salavich. Let me just turn off my other computer here. Good. Okay, if you recall last time we ended dealing with the Rav was asked about Talmud study for girls, obviously for women. I showed you the famous picture of him with Rabbi Saul Berman and Rabbi Willig. One of you wrote me that, and I had already seen this, that Rabbi Willig actually taught the first Talmud shiur for the women. I mean, he was the Rebbe. The Rav gave that famous introductory Talmud shiur. So let's see what the Rav, Rav's reply was. But before I get to that, I want to show you something. I picked this up at YU in April of this year. Headline of the commentator, three Talmud courses on Barron campus canceled for next year. And it begins, the Stern College for Women Jewish Studies Department will not be offering introductory intermediate Talmud next semester due to low enrollment. And basically, for all this stress on how it's so vital for women to have access to Talmud study, there doesn't seem to be much interest at Stern. The standard, it says here, is a minimum of 8 students for a course, and yet they couldn't get that. In fact, there was even much lower than that in some of them. I think one of them even had, it said, no one registered for it, if I recall. Yeah, it says that zero applicants for the second Talmud track. That's for I think for GPATs, and so basically, it shows that it's not of that great interest. So I don't know what you make of that. But something like YU, you'd think they would offer it anyway because it's part of the ethos of what Yeshiva University is. And there was a backlash, and they retracted the statement that they were going to cancel these courses. I don't know how many students are in it, but they're at least what I read is that they're going ahead with that. So I guess
that's because a very good fellow named slipped my mind. Volunteer to step in and teach the course. Shlomo's here.
So, but I mean, well, he was already teaching something, but the question
is,
whether
he picked us up extra.
If you only have, let's say, 3 students, do you offer it? And they saw that the public wanted it, and it's very important symbolically to offer these courses, even if there aren't many students. Remember, at Stern, it's not like YU. These are courses. It's not like you have a full morning of Gemara learning. So it is differently. And, okay, but before we get to that, see the Rav's answer, I want to mention again this book, An American Orthodox Dreamer. I don't know if it's still available because on pages 81 and on, he discusses the Rav in teaching Gemara. Actually, he identifies 2 different approaches to it. One from Rabbi Meir Tursky, in what he's written on this, that it's basically no different than the Chafetz Chaim creating the revolution for women's Torah study, girls teaching them Torah, because we're living in an era that if you don't teach them this, then they're going to be taken by the streets. So though the Chafetz Chaim wasn't referring to Talmud, Rabbi Tursky just sees this as a natural extension of precedent that had already been established by the Chafetz Chaim. On the other hand, he also quotes Rabbi Walter Wurzberger that sees it very differently. He sees this as a l'chadchila, as a way to give them an understanding of the halacha process, theoretical underpinnings of the halacha. I don't know if the difference between them is as stark as Rabbi Farber makes it, but you can read that there. He also, incidentally, deals with the co-ed issue, and he shows the different opinions from the different sides that what we spoke about last week is l'chachila, b'diavad, etc. In terms of Co-ed, I want to call your attention to two more things, or one more thing. I don't know if any of you know this book by Benny Kraut, The Greening of American Orthodox Judaism, Yavna in the 1960s. Yavna was an organization for college students in America, Orthodox. We're talking in the 60s, let's say, into the 70s. And if you look on page 52, it talks about there was a summer institute by Yavna for college-age men and women. It was held in the Jewish Center. And all classes were open to men and women equally, including co-ed Talmud classes at both the introductory and advanced levels. And it tells us that the introductory Talmud course was taught by Rabbi Melech Schechter. That's Rav Herschel Schechter. And Rav Lichtenstein taught advanced Talmud. So here we see Rabbi Lichtenstein teaching co-ed Talmud. Chaim Soloveitchik taught it. And Rabbi Nachman Bullman, I don't know if the name means anything to you, but he also taught it. I see I made a note about non-Jews in the Talmud class. I'll get to this next class, something I think you'll find interesting. But I can tell you that Professor Torsky, Rabbi Yitzhak Torsky, this is the other son-in-law of Rav Soloveitchik, in his Talmud class, he would give a Talmud class in his shul in Brookline, women could also attend. There were students, when I was working at Brandeis, a group of students went over and they came back so surprised coming to me that there was women in the Talmud class, which, okay, as we know, this is a distinction, a difference between the, I guess, the modern Orthodox and the Haredim. I told you, if you remember my classes on my latest book, the 53 classes, that although the Kollel was of great benefit, the Kollel of Brookline for the Brandeis, for the students, it really was an important and a great benefit, and it continues to this day. However, I also spoke about some of the problems, some of the difficulties, and one of the difficulties related to this. We dedicated a base medrash in 1994, and this base medrash was for everyone. It was even open 24 hours a day. And I remember some young women came to me complaining because the person who was giving the shiur came from the Kollel, the Gemara shiur. He said that women are not allowed in the Beis Medrash when he's giving it. And they came to complain because it's Beis Medrash, it's for everyone. They want to learn there. So that was one of the times I had to, only one of two times, as I recall, that I had to go up against the Kollel. And I have to say that that's not the way it works. The base medrash is for everyone. And you can't say that we're going to teach Gemara. And since women don't learn Gemara, they have to leave the base medrash. So they ended up taking the shiur to one of the lounges the student lounges in a dorm. But I would have even gone further. It isn't just that you can't say we're teaching Gemara shiur and therefore the women have to leave the base medrash. I said something even more. I said that every shiur in the base medrash, and I said this by virtue of my authority as the rabbi on campus, every shiur in the base medrash is open for men and women. It's not just that you can give a shiur for men and the women in the corner can't be thrown out if they want to study Chumash or something. I said that if it's in the base medrash, it has to be for everyone. Now, you know, if I think a little bit about it, there really could be times when you could make a distinction. Like, let's say there's some shiur on some aspect of sexuality. I can see that you could have a shiur just for men and a shiur, you know, just for women, or if a woman teacher comes in or something. But as a general rule, I was very firm on this, that if you're teaching an Arab based medrash, we anyone who wants to attend the shiur can come to the shiur. And that would work in the reverse, too. You know, if you had a woman Tanakh person, she couldn't advertise, you know, what shiur for women. That's not the way we worked it. The base medrash is for everyone. Everyone can come. I also Rav Avadia Yosef, I was surprised to find. Here's a sefer. It's called Roe Ne'aman. It's by Rabbi Yitzhak Schehebauer. He was the rabbi for the Syrians in Argentina, from Buenos Aires, for many years. If you look in this volume, Yoredeya, volume 2, page 233, we see that Rav Avadia Yosef was asked, "Inyan limud gemara l'nashim," and what did he say? "Im mitchasheket harbe laze mutar." If she really wants to learn, she can. But asur lachriach otam l'mod gemara, but you can't force them. So that means that in our high schools, he would not be too happy with it. because we do force them to learn. What is the issue, by the way? Okay, let me just quickly show you the issue that before we get to the Rav's answer here. Hold on, let me find. I got to pull it on the screen here. Let's see if I have it.
Mark?
Okay, I got it here.
Mark?
And then we'll see. Yes.
Can you please announce to everybody that they need to mute?
I can't hear you.
Please announce that everybody needs to mute.
Oh, well, I'll mute. I can mute everyone if everyone's not muted. Let me see. Oh, I see some people who are not muted. So I'll mute them. Yes. Okay, I think we're good now. Here's the Rambam. This is Perek Aleph. I think it's Perek Aleph of Talmud Torah, yes. And the same thing is found in the Shulchan Aruch. It says that a woman who learns, studies Torah, and receives reward. It says not as great as the man's because she's not commanded. Even though she received reward, the sages commanded that a person should not teach his daughter Torah because most women cannot concentrate their attention on study and transform the words of Torah into idle matters because of the lack of understanding. Thus, our sages declared, whoever teaches his daughter Torah is like one who teaches her tales and parables. That's a very strange translation. It says, Ke'ilo limda tifus. Tifus does not mean tales and parables. It refers to immorality or foolishness or something. And then it says, this applies to the oral law. But the written law, it says, one should not teach her, but if you teach her, it's not considered a taught idle thing. So basically, the Rambam is saying, but we know that if she wants to, if she studies, she receives a reward. It's a positive thing. But with Chachilo, you don't go ahead. So the question is, what about in our new era, where it's not the Rambam's day, we're not dealing with a Taliban-like society. Obviously, Judaism is not absorbed just by mother's milk or anything like that. So what are you supposed to do? So the Chafetz Chaim already dealt with this when he said that in our era, we need to teach Torah. And the Rav felt that it isn't just teaching Torah. The Rav felt that you have to go further. And the Rav felt that you have to teach Talmud as well. So what does the answer say here? Beginning on page 81, that we went through the question last time, he has two letters. The first letter is he doesn't want to reply unless they agree to accept what he says. He says he's worried that today we're in an era where there's so much partisanship. Some always want to liberalize the halacha, but others want to see the halacha fossilized. That's the word he used. And completely shut out of life. So the Rav is taking a middle of the road position against the liberals on the left and against the more traditionalists on the right who fossilized the halacha, that just because something was, just because the Rambam said this, then it wouldn't change. The fact that reality has changed entirely today, we wouldn't make any changes. The Chafetz Chaim said it's Hara Hashah, it's Eis L'Sos L'Hashem. You have to do it. It's an emergency time. So when Rabbi Rosenfeld said, we're going to listen to what you said, then the Rav replies, quote, today, not only is the teaching of Torah Shabbat Pep to girls permissible, but it's an absolute imperative. He says the policy of discrimination between the sexes as to subject matter and method of instruction that certain people advocate in our community has contributed to the deterioration and downfall of traditional Judaism. He says boys and girls alike need to be introduced to the inner halls, not just the surface level, inner halls of Torah Shabbat Pep. So you can't get any, he says, I'm going to prepare a halachic brief about this, but he doesn't do this here. As far as I know, it never came about. So here we see the Rav, as strong as you can get, stating that today we need to, look, women are getting advanced educations at universities, BAs, graduate school. We can't keep them at a high school, elementary school level in Torah study. And at the end of the day, women are smart. They realize if we know, and we do know, that the highest level of Torah learning is Talmud, and we're letting them achieve advanced degrees in secular studies, and we're not letting them achieve advanced study in Torah, they're not going to take it seriously. They're not going to, it's going to, they'll see it as a sign of disrespect to their intellect, who they are. It's going to have negative consequences. So, one of you emailed me about this and said, knowing what I was going to say, but wait a second, what about the halacha? I just read the halacha, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch says the same thing, that you can't do this. So, especially if we go with Rabbi Wurzburger, that this isn't a b'di'avad, Harad Shalom, the Chafetz Chaim, but this is something that he sees as a positive. That is, the women today are in the status of, on the days of the Rambam, that one in a million who'd be able to study, all our women have that level, because all our women are given secular education. Now, assuming that's what he holds, what do you do with the halacha? Well, the answer, of course, is that the halacha doesn't apply, because the halacha is not talking about our women. The halacha, again, the Rambam never says that a woman can't study. He says you shouldn't teach them, because there many of them, most of them in his day, are not suitable. They're not ready for it. They don't want it. The men are not suitable either. But there's a halacha, you have to teach men. It's they're obligated. The women are not obligated, but only a woman who shows that he's interested in it and takes the effort herself, okay, she can study it, and she's exceptional. From the Rav standpoint, he would say that all our women are exceptional in that sense, in that we all need to give them this education. And if you're still troubled by it, I want to share with you another source, an unusual source that I haven't seen anyone in this matter really deal with. I could have dealt with it when we dealt with reform. Because, look, if you're going to tell me it's a halacha, and how do you change halacha? Now, I don't buy it. I don't think it's halacha unchanging. I think the halacha from day one always depended on the people, the women, the era. But let's assume you go with the more traditionalist perspective, that it's a halacha, and you can't change the halacha. So let me then tell you that, and maybe this will put me in the camp of the reformers at the beginning, but wait till you see who I quote. I don't think I'll end up in the camp of the reformers, that who says that all halachot are eternal? I know we're indoctrinated with this, that halacha can't change, it's all eternal, it doesn't, but who says that? And I want to call your attention to something said by the Malbim. Malbim Meir Leibish Weiser, the Malbim, we know him as a great commentator on Torah Tanakh, but he was also at a halachic scholar. Now, there's a story, actually, of him and if I'm not mistaken, the Rav tells this story too, but it's told by a number of, I found it online. I just searched for it. I found two versions of it. The story, the Malbim wrote a Sefer Arts HaSachayim, and that's a commentary on the first sections of the Shulchan Aruch. And he went to Pressburg. We're going to be going to Pressburg this summer. You're all cordially invited. And we'll talk a good deal about the Chasam Sofer when we're there. And he went and he got a haskama from the Chasam Sofer, a very nice haskama on the Sefer. There's two versions of the story. The most popular version is as follows. And I found it for those who want to see it. I just found it. It's found many places. Mordechai Lifson's Midor, volume 4, page 236. So he comes to the Chasam Sofer. He begins it by saying, why did the Chasam Sofer cry on Shabbos, every Shabbos? The story is as follows. When he was 18 years old, he wrote this book, Arts HaSachayim, and it made him famous. He came to Pressburg. He was with the Chasam Sofer to get a haskama on the book, and Chasam Sofer, as I said, spoke to him in learning, gave him the haskama. But he was there as Shabbos comes, and it's getting dark. So he comes in Shabbos afternoon. He comes into shul, and it's hard to see. You know, he didn't know his way around, and maybe I don't think there was a sign, whatever. He goes and he sits in the Chasam Sofer's chair, and he actually dozes off, because the community was reciting Tehillim for about an hour before they would daven. The Chasam Sofer comes in and he sees him sitting in his chair, and the Chasam Sofer goes and sits on the side. When Ma'ariv starts and the Shamas is making Havdalah on the coast, the Malbim realizes that, wait a second, he's sitting in the Chasam Sofer's chair, and he gets all flustered, and he jumps up and he moves away, and he's being fayes to appease, I guess is the best word, the Chasam Sofer. And the Chasam Sofer said, no, you know, stay where you are. And the story is, from that moment, the Chasam Sofer stood where he is. That is, he stood where he is in learning, and he was never able to write any more halacha. He just couldn't reach that level. This is the explanation given why the Malbim never again wrote in halacha, and he had to go write in Nach, and that's why he would cry every Shabbos. I found a different version of this in a book called Otzar Yadus, volume 1, page 597, where what he says is, the way they read it is, stay where you are, mean don't write any more of this Sefer. But the traditional story is that it's like a curse of sort, not that the Chasam Sofer meant it, but that the Malbim would not write any more halacha, and it was removed from him the ability. But he did write the Sefer Artes Chaim. And if you look in Simon Tes, Sif Katan Mem Aleph, he goes through numerous examples where halacha changes because the reality is not the same. Oh, no, we know some of them. We don't have Melech Sodomis anymore. So we don't need to do, let's say, Mayim Achronim. He gives a lot of examples where he says you don't need a Minyan Latirim. That is, normally when we spoke already in the previous semester, when if the Chazal make a decree, we need another Sanhedrin greater than them, or, in number, or in wisdom. To get rid of it. He gives examples where you don't have this, and he says, Yimselameos. He says you'll find hundreds of examples where times have changed and you don't need it. And he says that only when they've told you that when it's clear that the Sanhedrin passed it, then you're stuck. But if it's just halacha, so for example, he says, what about, it says that you can't dance on Shabbos because you might v'shem v'takim kli. We spoke about it, and then Tosel says we're not experts in fixing an instrument, and he gives lots of examples where you don't need. So what does he conclude? He says that for many halachot, he goes on 2 pages, 3 pages on this, and he quotes a different rishonim because there's a lot of confusion. But his conclusion is that when it's built into the halacha from the beginning, that it depends on the circumstance, then if circumstances change, the halacha by itself changes. When halacha is made a gezeira, like a Sanhedrin or the Rabbanan, just a stam gezeira, by a minyan, let's say, by the Sanhedrin or something like that, then you need another Sanhedrin to change it. But if, listen to his language, I want to show you, he says, Rak hecha sheyadinan sheasanhedri gedola gazru hadavar beminyan. Only when you know that there was an actual like a decree from the Sanhedrin, then you need it. Then you need another Sanhedrin. Aval dinim acherim, other laws. Afal pishich ziku behem kol shelo yadanu shenigzru beminyan. Also other laws, all the run of the mill laws you see in the Gemara that we all follow. And there's no reason to think. We don't know that they were, it was like a Sanhedrin made a gezeira. Ein sarich minyan latirum. You do not need a Sanhedrin to do that. Again, stam dinim, I guess you could say. Regular laws, where it just says in the Gemara that this is the halacha, he says that you could say, nispato hatam, bato ha'isr. If the reason for it has gone away, then the Isser goes away. Now, this is very problematic, you might say, and it's going to be controversial. After all, the Vilna Gaon says that just because, even when the Gemara gives a reason, just because it gives a reason, there could be other reasons. But the point is that the Malbim sets forth this principle that, at least with many halachot, they're dependent on the time, so that fits in very well with the Rav's position. In an era where women got no education, this is an issue. This could be a problem. That's the halacha. But now that it's a totally different era, the halacha doesn't apply anymore. And not that it's a Rosh Shah or anything like the Chafetz Chaim, but the halacha simply does not apply anymore because it was not stated for our era. Those who want more about this, and you can have a whole article on this, so that the Malbim and the Tosfos in a number of places, he's following Tosfos in a number of places. Where they say Ha'idna, today it doesn't apply, and they give the reason. Now, it's true that other Rishonim often disagree with Tosfos, but the Malbim follows the Tosafist perspective, and again, that's in the Arts of Sahayim. Okay, so that's the Rav's position, and he advocated it, and then it wasn't just in high school. We saw in Stern College, Talmud study, advanced Talmud study, and this became pretty standard in the modern Orthodox world. Even in schools that, like the schools near me, where it's not co-ed, they still teach women Talmud, not in every seminary in Israel. But the seminaries that don't, my sense is that it's because they don't think there's much of an interest. So you have the seminaries that do, the seminaries that don't. And that's become, yes, and with the problem that Rabbi Willock spoke about, that once you open up the bottle here, the genie's bottle, who knows where it's going to lead? And it might lead to places that things that some people, even students of Soloveitchik, are not very happy about. But we don't know what the Rav would say if he was alive today. He might just say that that's, you know, life is dangerous. It's full of dangers. But we can't go back to the ghetto, and not teaching them Talmud is going to bring more dangers. They're going to abandon Judaism. They won't take it seriously. So there's a lot to say about this. And believe me, many people have written on this issue. I just wanted to tell you this short letter where the Rav, in just a few lines, waxes eloquent about how vital this is. The next letter, pages 85 and on, deal with the creation of Yeshiva University's Albert Einstein Medical School. I don't know. I think now it's not even, although they, it's not controlled by YU, although it still is kosher and all the, as far as I know, it still follows the rules that it was when it was controlled by YU, but it's not under YU's, as if I understand it correctly, it's not under YU's control at all anymore. People can correct me if I'm wrong, but of course it was founded. And the question was, should YU have a medical school? First of all, you can, the more general question is, what's the point? Why does Yeshiva University need a medical school? Why does it need a law school? It was founded as a college so people could study Talmud, Torah, intensively, and also have secular studies and be in a Jewish environment. And you go to Cardozo or you go to Einstein, I mean, is that really a Jewish environment? Do we need to have all this money? Yes, you could take a course in Judaism, but is it really necessary? So that's one approach you could look at it. But actually, and that's what the Rav deals with. The question to him, which he dealt with, is that there are people in the Orthodox world, this is taking us back to the 50s, who thought that this is not something that Yeshiva University should get involved with. As it says, their role is to train, you know, to teach Torah, basically. Why should we extend into new areas by establishing secular graduate and professional schools that have no direct connection with Torah? What's the point of it? Not only is it, then you could raise other issues, obviously. You know, someone's going to give all this money to Einstein or Cardozo. That's maybe money that could go to the yeshiva. So what's the point of it? I have the same question when I think about Toro, everything Toro's doing. Well, how is that connect? I'm not talking about Lander College, but all the other schools. How, what does that have to do with Judaism? Okay, so the Rav deals with this. And the Rav, a very interesting essay. When it comes to Cardozo, I'll get back. I'll tell you something interesting about Cardozo when I finish here. The Rav deals with a medical school, and he starts off by saying that, listen, it wasn't given to, this is Dr. Belkin's plan, and he succeeded marvelously. He was a big dreamer, Dr. Belkin. Of course, it created all sorts of problems for him because financially and, I mean, lots of difficulties, almost bankrupted the school, but he was a great builder, and you couldn't say no to him because he had such a vision. The Rav says, I don't know what I would have said had I been consulted before they went ahead with this. I wasn't asked, and therefore I'm not speaking to you l'chachila. I'm speaking to b'diavad. Now you're going to see how strong the Rav is about the medical school. But he still says that doesn't mean I would have this opinion if you would ask me ahead of time. Because like I said already, maybe at the end of the day, maybe it's a big waste of money. The millions and millions of dollars it cost to raise could have been used better just strictly for Torah. And, with all the stress on these, it could distract us. Obviously, in later years, you could say that we saw what happened with the medical school and the law school as well, where you have a secular or non-Jewish student body and as well as faculty, and ideas are pushed that put yeshiva in a difficult position because you have clubs that are in direct opposition to the values of Yeshiva University. This is before, obviously, everyone could even imagine that in the very heart of Yeshiva University, you'd have these same clubs. But those are other issues. But the Rav, now that they've established the medical school, the Rav says that, in his opinion, this will accomplish a great deal for Orthodox Judaism in America, provided the leadership remains under religious control with Dr. Belkin at the helm. When Dr. Belkin's running it, he says, I have faith. And before we go further, let me just say that a big misconception that people have is that if you're in medical school, it's just like you're a doctor and you're saving lives. And, you know, many people in medical school think that Shabbos doesn't matter and that Shabbos can be suspended because you're in future training to be a doctor. Now, obviously, you have to ask your posek, but I can tell you without fear of contradiction by any posek that Shabbos is not suspended, even if you're in medical school. And sometimes the things you could do things, you could violate it. I mean, again, that's something you need to speak with Code Postcom about. But the idea that there is no such thing as Shabbos in medical school is obviously a falsehood, a fallacy. And therefore, already you're going to see that the idea that you could have a medical school, which is going to enable Jews who are observant to be in an environment that Shabbos is important, that's going to be vital. So it's a long essay here. He talks about the medical curriculum. There's going to be issues about, let's say, autopsy. I mean, you can imagine all the problems there's going to be. But then he says, he talks about Shabbos here, that people go to medical school and they assume that they're going to have to violate Shabbos, all the things I just mentioned. But then he continues. He says that the establishment of the medical school at YU obviates all the issues of Shabbos and halacha, all the issues that make it practically impossible for an Orthodox Jew to study medicine. In YU's medical school, no lectures will be presented on Shabbos. In the 50s, you had all sorts of classes on Shabbos in schools. The laboratories were closed on Shabbos. Shabbos was the official day of rest. He says there's going to be a kosher cafeteria, Beit Midrash. And then he talks about in the second paragraph section how Jewish doctors, again, I wasn't alive then, but in the 1950s, he says Jewish American doctors have no respect for religious values. The way he portrays it is that the average doctor in the 1950s, Jewish doctor, is, let's put it this way, is a very negative view, is antagonistic to Torah values. He says, we know of situations where physicians influence mothers to feed their children ham and eggs for breakfast. They told them that this is important. Or leaven on Passover. He says that today it's impossible, practically impossible for a rabbi to discuss the issue of an ill person fasting on Yom Kippur with Jewish doctors because their response is cynical, he says, and vulgar. We know that according to halacha, if you want to know to fast on Yom Kippur, what does the rabbi know? So you have to speak to the doctor. The rabbi will speak to the doctor for you. But that's the assumption when the poskim spoke about that they meant the doctor who was religious. And if he's not religious, at least one who has a positive attitude towards religious. But if the doctor himself is cynical and vulgar, the rub's words, and thinks the whole idea of fasting is from the beginning stupid, then you can't ask them because they're never going to give you a straight answer. Their approach to people is built on a superficial, mechanistic, positivistic approach. So we need doctors for halacha. We need doctors simply to ask a question about, like, on Yom Kippur. When my wife was pregnant on Yom Kippur, I called Rabbi Tendler. He's a rabbi doctor, you could ask, because, you know, the doctor says no fasting. On the other hand, we know the halacha says, and later I found that Rabbi Fisher, by the way, Fisher from the Eda Haredis, gave an unbelievable psak that all pregnant women don't fast on Yom Kippur, which is against the Shulchan Aruch, but he said that today we're weak. So I had to get an answer from someone who, you know, I didn't feel like I could call up a rabbi and say, well, this is what Shulchan Aruch said, because, you know, you have the doctor and the rabbi. So I figured a rabbi doctor, then... So I called Rabbi Tendler. He goes on and says that a significant portion of the doctors that graduate from Yeshiva's medical school will consist of Torah scholars and observant Jews, and the remainder will have an appreciation. So that he continues by saying that we have to demonstrate, you know, after speaking about the medical school in the particulars, how advantageous it is to have Jewish doctors who can understand these matters and respond, he speaks in generality. He says, we have to show that in all cultural, social, and scientific situations, a Jew can study Torah and live as a faithful Torah Jew. And this idea that in the right-wing circles, because they don't allow you to go to university, what they're saying is that a Jew can't be a doctor. They're not saying that there's something usher about a Jew being a doctor, but in order for a Jew to be a doctor, you have to go to college, you have to go to medical school. So practically, in those communities, it's impossible to be a religious Jew and be a doctor. And the Rav has the exact opposite position. We have to show, on the contrary, that we can be a faithful Torah Jew and be a doctor. We must show the world that halacha does not restrain the intellectual, emotional capacities and worldly knowledge. On the contrary, it broadens and deepens them. That's the biggest Kiddush Hashem. Very Hirschian here, that you're going to have a Jewish doctor. We must demonstrate the false or the complaints of the non-religious and pseudo-religious movements that say that halacha limits you. After all, it was the non-Orthodox that were saying that exactly what the right wing was saying, that you can't be a religious doctor. And there weren't any religious doctors. For the Rav, that's a big Chil Hashem, that there's no religious doctors, quite apart from the practical problems this creates, that you need a religious doctor to answer shilas, because the rabbi doesn't know, so the rabbi needs to consult. But the very idea that you do not have religious doctors is itself a Chil Hashem, because we are supposed to show that halacha broadens us, not that it limits us. He says that we don't respond to their claims with theoretical arguments. We need to show practical examples and deeds. If the yeshiva will endeavor to produce a first-class medical school and thereby enable students to combine a Torah lifestyle with the medical profession, it will have accomplished a great deal to enhance the honor of Torah and the prestige of Orthodoxy. You're in the 1950s here. You're going to tell Orthodox Jews that they can't become doctors? How many of them are going to be young people are going to remain Orthodox? They want to be a doctor. You say you can't be a doctor? You have to make a choice between Shabbos, Kashrus, and being a doctor? We're going to lose that. We lost that in the 19, before Shem Sharaf Ahersh came around, we lost that battle also. Because the old time Orthodox were saying that you couldn't have any secular education. You had to remain as a merchant. You couldn't be a lawyer. You couldn't be a doctor. You couldn't be a government worker. You couldn't be a white collar professional. And we know exactly what happened. Within the space of two generations, every one of these big communities in Germany that were majority Orthodox became controlled by the Reform. Until Shem Sharaf Ahersh arises on the scene and says, no. It's not a choice between one or the other. We could be a religious Jew, and we could have all these things. And on the not only that, but that's what the Torah wants us to do. It wants us to be a part in all circles of life. So he ends by saying that I hope that my optimistic expectations will not be proven false, that the yeshiva will not allow itself to be led astray from its task by some philanthropist or medical school administrator, who wants to isolate the religious aspect of the school. I think people who attended Einstein or Cardozo, you can speak to the fact, did the religious Jews become a ghetto at these places, or is the vision of the Rav that the religious identity of the university, of yeshiva, will encompass the entire medical school? I mean, for the Rav, the idea that you can graduate, let's say Einstein or Cardozo later, and not understand that you're in a Torah institution is incomprehensible to him. I wonder if I know you could take courses from people like Rabbi Bleich or Rabbi Tenger used to, and others. You take a medical ethics course, but I've met non-religious people who've graduated from these places. I wonder, if it's just a medical school or a law school where you could take a couple of religious courses and you don't have classes on Shabbos and Yom Tov. That's not what the Rav is referring to. The Rav, he's talking about, as he says, that it's, it has to, the medical school itself will be a representative of the yeshiva. So I don't know. I haven't been to either of them, so I can't speak to it, but I'd love to hear if any of you, what you have to say about it. Now, I mentioned the law school. Because although the Rav doesn't deal with the law school, you know that his position would be the same. But I had a different issue about the law school, and I want to share it with you because I think you'll find it of interest. And this wasn't included in my book, my latest book, and we didn't deal with it for that reason, simply because the correspondence is in English. And there, with one exception, or two exceptions, everything was in Hebrew. But if I ever do part one, and if I don't do part two of it, I'll include it. And if I don't do part two, I'll post it online. If you know this book by Rabbi Michael J. Broyd, Pursuit of Justice and Jewish Law, Halachic Perspectives on the Legal Profession, it, let's see, what year is that? I don't even know what year. About 20 years ago, maybe, he refers on a number of occasions to a letter from Rabbi Bleich to a Jewish, to a student. Yeah, that's what he calls it. Letter from, well, who's the student? I'm the student. Now, why didn't he say letter from Rabbi Jenny or back to Mark Shapiro? I don't know, but it's a letter from, in fact, here is the letter. 3-page letter, which I will summarize to you and tell you the story now. I wrote to Norman Lamb, Dr. Norman Lamb, in January of 1987. I was all of 21 years old. And sorry, December 1987, Rabbi Blech's responses then. Rabbi Dr. Lamb gave the letter to Rabbi Blech to respond it because my question was simple. I wrote to him, what rationale is there for Yeshiva University to have a law school? We have a lot of lawyers listening to us. My question wasn't about the things the Rav was dealing with, but I was dealing with a pure halachic matter. I guess it would be the same if Einstein violated halacha in some ways. But I said, you're teaching... you're having courses which are teaching people to then use lawyers who are then going to be hired and are going to be involved in lawsuits against Jews when we know that you can't sue a Jew in a court. You have to go to Beis Din. I said, while it is obvious that not all Jews will follow the law and many non-Jews also will attend the law school, isn't the presence of such a school giving the wrong impression as to Yeshiva's attitude to secular courts? Many people can point to the existence of a Cardozo and say that if there's something wrong with secular courts, why would Yeshiva University have a law school? And I said, well, isn't there a question of Lifnei Iver? You're training all these students to go out and then violate halacha because they're going to the secular courts instead of Beis Din. I said, the crux of the issue is why should an Orthodox institution sponsor a school that will teach methods of jurisprudence for practical application at variance with Jewish law? Now, I'm not being a kanai here or anything. I was curious to know the religious justification for training people who are then going out and are not going to go to Beis Din. So he sends it to Rabbi Blech to reply. And Rabbi Blech has a 3-page letter here. And it's a fascinating letter. It's never appeared in print. I should ask him if he lets me appear it in print. He talks about, first of all, there's all sorts of areas that don't violate the prohibition on going to secular courts, immigration law and tax law, corporate law. And then he puts forth a chiddush. He says that when you're dealing with irreligious Jews, he thinks that, he says, I might add that there may be grounds for relaxation of the prohibition. We're talking about going to secular courts in cases where the defendant is entirely non-observant. Rabbi Blech feels that if you deal with a non-observant Jew, because of what? You're a lawyer. You're supposed to, you've been told you're going to sue this other Jew. Are you supposed to actually summon him first to Beis Din? If it's two religious Jews, we know before you go to secular court, you have to summon them to Beis Din. If they don't go to Beis Din, then you go to secular court. But that doesn't work in the real world. You tell that to any client of yours, he'll dump you immediately. We got to summon to Beis Din. I don't want to go to Beis Din. I want to go to, the secular court. And in this, why it wouldn't matter whether the guy's Jewish, religious or not religious, apparently, at least I thought. But Rabbi Blech says no. He says that, there's a presumption that the summons would be ignored. And since it's, he argues that since we can assume it's going to be ignored, that therefore you don't even have to summon them. Because we know that the non-religious Jew is not going to Beis Din, the non-Jew is not going to Beis Din. Rabbi Blech says that there are sources that say you should even summon a non-Jew to Beis Din. He says, since we know it's not going to happen, he said that, he's saying that he offers it as the limud zchus, that they're not going to go, so why go through it? So then the whole problem of going to secular court is really evaporates. It would only apply if you're dealing with two religious Jews. And then, Taka, you would have a real problem. But how often does that apply where you don't... So very interesting letter. And this is one of the issues that you'd have with a secular law school, and I guess with all the graduate schools, you could have problems, but there are solutions to it. So I thank Rabbi Blech. I think it's a very, very beautiful letter, and I really should ask him permission to publish it because it really sets forth a very interesting perspective. He cites many achronim, and very nice. Okay. Enough with that. I want to now go to page 93 in the book. What's the next question? He asks. The rabbinical school. In the 1955, Dr. Belkin, he must have turned to the Rav, because the Rav, the Rav, he writes this letter. It's addressed to Dr. Belkin. Dr. Belkin thought about revising the curriculum at the rabbinical school. So he turned to the Rav. And the Rav has a fascinating perspective on this. It's not a short letter. He wrote it in English also. And there's a lot to say about it, but let me just call attention to a few things that I think will touch some interesting chords here. He notes that our yeshivas today cannot be like the yeshivas of old. In Halachic Man, the Rav portrays Limud Torah Lishma as the be-all and end-all, and the what they did in, let's say, Volozhin, that was the goal. But that's in theory. In practice, he says, it's a direct contradiction, because in practice, he says, it doesn't work. In fact, he says that the yeshivas of old don't work for today. He says, first of all, the yeshivas of old, we're talking Volozhin, Sabot, Gamir, all that, they never attempted to serve the general community. They were only interested in accommodating the selected few. He calls it, he says these were esoteric institutions. Remember I said that yeshivas Hechel Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi in Boston, the Rav established, he wanted it to be for everyone, not just for the big Talmidei Chachamim, even for local Jews. The Rav says, and he's correct, that the yeshivas were only designed for the elites. Only a few discovered the spiritual riches of the yeshivas. The course of study, method of instruction, and substance of the lectures revolved about the genius and were organized for the specific purpose of developing the great minds. So you're dealing with elites, elites of the elites. Is that what we have at Yeshivas Ribbitz Ochanan? Are we dealing with the elites of the elites here? We deal with people who want to serve the Jewish people. But are these Gedolei Yisrael? No! 99.9% of them are going to rabbinate to serve the Jewish people, not to become lamdanim of the highest caliber. Especially then, it was a 2-year smicha program. The Rav is going to recommend 3 years. Now it's 4 years, actually. He says, the average student was the forgotten man who benefited very little by his residence at the yeshiva. And then he goes further and says that the yeshiva had no idea of general halachic education. They had no understanding of the crying need of basic knowledge of the halacha at a layman's level in order to educate and enlighten communal leadership. You could be in yeshiva 15 years and you don't know what it means to pascha neshila. That was such a problem that Volozhin had to open up a kollel. Rav Simcha Zelig, the Dayan of Brisk, studied there. Sobotka later did the same thing. Rav Yaakov Chomanetsky studied there, because you can come out of 15 years studying in the yeshiva and not know how to paskin a shayla, never having learned your day. I told you already, Arisa Zalman Meltzer, one of the Gedolei Yisrael, Rosh Yeshiva of Slutsk, when the position in the city of Slutsk opened up, they wanted to make him the rabbi, but he had never learned your day. He never had smicha. So the Rav sees this as a big problem, because it's a problem because you're not going to be today, he uses the words, an enlightened communal leadership. Today, the rabbis are not just in the stratosphere. They have to deal with the people in a different way. And they have to understand how halacha works. They have to understand how halacha works. Tzak, the history of halacha, shelos and shuvos, that works differently than theoretical halacha. I told you this before, I'll say it again. I was at a shiur where a rabbi was talking about what you need to convict someone according to Jewish law. You know, two edim, the two edim need to give hasra, warning beforehand. And we have in the room there someone who's a DA in one of the big towns near me. And he said, if that's the case, then we never could convict anyone. Because look, when was the last time they got a murderer, a robber, who did it in front of witnesses and was warned ahead of time? And the rabbi's response was, that's our system. I thought that was the biggest chil Hashem, and it showed the rabbi didn't know. He knew the Gemaras, not all the Gemaras, but he knew the theoretical, how we all learned that you knew to aid him. What he should have said is, the Rosh already said, and the Rashba and many others, that since today we can't enforce the law using this, therefore, based and has the authority to use extrajudicial means. So no, the person who gets up in front of a Hadassah Women's Convention and shoots someone is not going to be let off, because you don't have two male witnesses. On the contrary, they'll arrest them and they'll throw them in the jail and they'll do everything to them, because the based and has the authority. We've spoken about this. This is Iran. The Ron's a position, but it's not just the Ron. The Rambam himself speaks about emergency measures, Shimon ben Shattuch, what he did to the witches. The point is that you need to know how halacha has operated in diaspora, and then you wouldn't tell a district attorney. Basically, you're saying that our system of jurisprudence can't work because you need two witnesses ahead of time to warn them. Means you can do anything you want and get away with it. That's not the way halacha works. I think that's sort of what the Rav is referring to as well. And he says that in the yeshivas, sometimes they spend too long on sugyas, exaggerated qualitative analysis. He mentions that they would spend, I'll read it for you in a minute, the exact word that he mentions about how long they spent on the sugya, if I could find it. Then he talks about the Musar movement. He's not such a fan of the Musar movement. We're going to deal with the Musar movement. Future classes, the opposition to the Musar movement. Rav Soloveitchik, a halachic man, he talks about Rav Chaim Brisker, why he didn't allow Musar into the Volozhin Yeshiva. So he says that some of the yeshivas, the Musar movement, created a quasi-monastic world-negating philosophy, and that led to a segregation of the Ben Torah from the masses. He speaks of the tragic results of such a mental attitude. You know, I have to say about the Rav that... for all his reevaluation, he still held on to this anti-Musar position because it really isn't true. In Halachic Man, he does say that under the altar of Sobotka, this extremism didn't continue. But here he just generalizes here. That was the case with some adherents of the Musar movement, but in most of the great Rosh Yeshiva and Rabbanim we had in America before the war came out of the Musar yeshivas. He also says that the yeshivas of old didn't know how to formulate a religious philosophy in universal terms and didn't know how to translate halachic ideas into philosophical vernacular. The Rav's whole theory was that he was going to create a philosophy out of the halacha. But it has to be a philosophy. And philosophy means, as he says, you need to know Sadia, Yehuda Levi, and the Rambam. And he says that in the yeshivas, the methods that were employed by Sadia, Yehuda Levi, and Rambam are classified as heretical and destructive. What he's saying is that for a sophisticated philosophy of halacha in the modern era, you need a grasp of philosophy, of Western philosophy. You need to be able to formulate it in modern intellectual terms. And in the yeshiva world, they completely reject this. They don't just reject, you know, Kant and Hegel and all the value of Western philosophy. They reject the Jewish philosophers, their whole systems. And so you'll have observance of halacha for those people who choose to observe. But the only way you're going to make halacha appealing, the only way you're going to show that it's sophisticated, And for the Rav, I think it's even more. I think it's the Kiddush Hashem of showing what halacha is at the highest level of understanding. In today's day and age, you need to explain it by means of philosophy. You need to. And if you're going to tell me that the Rambam and Sadia and their whole approach is heretical, or at best, we don't study this stuff, then automatically you're handicapped. And you can never write a work like Halachic Man, Halachic Mind, all these things. Without philosophy, you can't write it. And the Rav feels that we need sophisticated halachic philosophy. He says, the yeshiva world has never instituted a promotion system and has ignored all formal means of checking the knowledge and accomplishments of the students. You could sit in the yeshiva for a whole year and basically being batel yozman. They don't know if you've what you've achieved. Are they testing you? Or do they promote you? Different levels? It was in the yeshivas, as we know. It was very informal. So these are all the things that the Rav says we have to change. He says that we're committed to halacha, but not to parochial educational methods evolved under the stress of certain historical circumstances and conditions which no longer exist. Again, he says we are just as committed to halacha as the right wing, but we're not committed to parochial educational methods that were evolved under the stress of certain historical circumstances. He says, we will not go on teaching halacha along these lines. So the Rav is stating that our yeshiva needs to be different than the yeshiva of the 19th century, than Volozhin, than Sobotka. We're in a different era. And just because they taught it one way then, we don't teach it this way now. Amazing, I think. And he says that we're not only interested in training outstanding scholars, but enlightened and conscientious rabbis. in the yeshiva world, the point of it was to create Gedol Yisrael. That was the point. But the Rav reckoned, and Rav Edesler has a letter about this, in which he explains that we'll sacrifice, 999 for the one Gedol. Rabbi Schwab has a whole response to this. Like, how can you say that? What about the rest of Kal Yisrael? But that's the job of the yeshivas, to create Gedol Yisrael. The Rav understands that yeshivas for Ritzel Chana is not about creating Gedol Yisrael. You could have Gedol Yisrael come out of it. There have been. But that's not its reason, that's not its purpose. And that's not what everything is focused on. Rather, what it's focused on, as he says, page 98, sincere, enlightened, and conscientious rabbis. You could create another institution. And that could be just to train Gedol Yisrael. They created a kolo at YU. There was more than one kolo. But they create Rav Sipperstein was the Rosh kolo, as I recall. That could be, but for the average rabbi coming in, you can't have a curriculum which is just to produce Gedol Yisrael. That's why they have to take classes in homiletics and in history. Of course they need Jewish history because they're speaking to the people. They need to know. Otherwise, the old joke, they won't know what came first, Purim or Hanukkah. And it's not just world history, general history. You need to have a college education. You can't go to Yeshiva Sri Tzachana if you don't have a college degree, because when you come out, you need to have a knowledge of the Western world. You're going to be dealing with Balabati, who are college educated. If you come in and you don't understand the Western world, they won't take you seriously. He says, to spend a full year on the study of 15 Bot, sacrificing thus an entire Masechta for the sake of ingenious scholastic debates, borders, mildly speaking, on the ridiculous. There were yeshivas that spent this. Not all yeshivas, but many of them did. And the Rav says we have to, you have to do many, many pages. And then he continues that the yeshiva has to train the students in practical halakha, not just theoretical halakha. And he goes on talking about the need for philosophical training. That is, the first he sets forth is a very long letter. It's like 10 pages. First he sets forth the problem, and then he gives his solution. He says that there has to be a promotion system. He signs the identical smicha for the mediocre and the brilliant. He thinks that there should be a recognition of the top students. I guess like we have in universities, we have summa cum laude, magna cum laude, and he says that there's no mark of recognition for the good students. So you can have two different types of smichas, or three, for the superstars and for the more average. Then he says, let's raise it to 3 years. He says the leading theological seminaries, that he's talking about Christians, require 3 years. No, they require a BA degree and 4 years residence. So we require a BA, at least we should require 3 years. And then he says, of the 3 years, 1 year each on different code. So, for example, he says that 1 year you devote to Yoredeya, 1 year to Evan Ezer and the Gemaras that go along with it. And then he says, 1 year Archaim. Not Choshen Mishpat. Choshen Mishpat already is specialized. The local rabbi doesn't need to know Choshen Mishpat unless he's sitting on a beis din. But he says that in all these areas, you need the, every rabbi needs to know these problems. He says it doesn't mean that the typical rabbi is going to render decisions about Aguna and Gittin, but he needs to understand the issues. And then he says that in Orach Chaim, importance vital. Laws of Tefillah, Kriyat Shema, Hilchos Shabbos, and then he throws in, and this is not Orach Chaim, he says Hilchos Aveilus. You need to have Hilchos Aveilus. And he says that they need to know Chumash thoroughly with the Ramban and Rashi. And philosophy. You have to know Emunos Fideos, the Sadia, Chovos Avavos, the Kuzari, Amor Nebuchim. He says that you don't need to deal with those matters that are just medieval, that deal with pure medieval type of Aristotelian physics or metaphysics, but anything that focuses on moralistic rhetorical ideas or has lasting value, they need to know. So it's a great letter setting forth his vision. How much did, it's more than 10 pages, 13 pages. How much did Yeshiva Sri Ritzel Hanan measure up? I don't know. We have our Musmachim, they can tell us. They certainly, there was a goal. It used to have a master's from the Bernard Rebbe Graduate School that now has changed. Instead, you can do Kollel, but you still need to have a BA. It is true. You can graduate. You can graduate as a musmach. You can go to Yeshiva College and be an economics major and then go to smicha. You can graduate without having any knowledge of Jewish history or Jewish philosophy. So from the Rav standpoint, that's a problem. That's a lacuna. That should not be allowed. They changed the curriculum, so they allowed, if I'm not mistaken, they changed, well, I don't need to get into the story. It had to do with Professor Felbrum and one of the Gedolei Yisrael at YU who wouldn't take his class. I think that's why they changed it. But so I don't think the Rav will be completely satisfied with what's there today. On the one hand, you have people who are greater Lamdanim coming out. On the other hand, some of them, if they don't know basic ideas in Jewish philosophy and the other things the Rav was speaking about, which you get, you only get, I'm not saying you only can get it in a graduate level, but if you're not taking any of the Jewish studies courses at YU, you won't get it. And there are some rabbis who don't take it. So it's a lack. What can you say? I see it's already 9:30. So let's stop. We're going to continue next class, moving into the next section of this book deals with orthodoxy in the American Jewish community. We don't need to go through all the things about Mechitza because we already dealt with that. But there's other issues that deal with the relationship of orthodoxy and non-orthodoxy. You'll see the Rav's interesting opinion. And you'll hear next class about why it was part of the letter, but I'll get to it next class because we didn't have time. Why the Beis HaLevi was forced to divorce his first wife. The Rav, as his great-grandson, will tell us about it. We know about it from other places. And it relates to what the Rav says in this letter. He had a forceful father-in-law, the Beis HaLevi. Wait till you hear why he forced the great Beis HaLevi to divorce his daughter. Did YU hire anyone to replace Rabbi Konowitz? Rabbi Zukier, who was already teaching there, I think he's teaching the courses. Alan says that the Gemara at Stern, maybe those who need this course are going elsewhere. Maybe they're in a higher track. Well, the article is dealing with first both things. First of all, the higher track, which still had people, but of a lower level. And then the lower track, which it wasn't reaching the level to fill the course. I think it said they need 8 students. So if you only have 6 students, from what I've been led to believe, the powers that be were convinced that even if you have 5 or 6 students, this is so important, you know, women's Talmud study, that the dean has discretion to allow a course to run with less students. If it's important, if it's like every other course, then no, you have a number and then you can't go below the number. But look, if you remember when Rabbi Jonathan Sachs was at YU, if he's at YU and he offers a course, let's say, and only 5 students, they're all afraid of him, only 5 students will sign up, they're going to let it run. Because the dean has discretion. This is Rabbi Sachs. So the same thing. The dean has discretion. So they didn't expect the response. The response was so strong that how could Stern get rid of the Talmud for girls, for women? But from what I understand, they backtracked. Yes, and Mark says differentiate between undergrad Gemara courses and cheap paths. It speaks about both of them in that article. Samuel says he graduated MIMO in 1957, the Sugyos and the Gemara were among the most difficult. It's the Shabbos, Basar Bechov, you know, Kol Basar, you know, like all the girls studied it. Yes, the Rav wanted that, and he taught it to his daughters. David says, I think the Rambam himself opened the floodgates with the word Rov. Rov Hanashim, yeah, most women, 100%. And the beginning of the Halacha, the Rambam says that that if the woman studies it, she receives a reward. So he doesn't say she sinned or anything because she's already, we see that, you know, she's at the level to do it. But the Rambam's, the issue for him is to teach them. If they want to study it on their own, it's not a problem. We don't go ahead and teach them because they might be unworthy students. But from a Soloveitchik's perspective, today you have to teach them. So what about the unworthy students? Okay, you know, you have a lot of unworthy men students and there's no choice anymore. In today's day and age, we need to have highly educated. That's how I think he would answer that. Someone privately emails me that the Rush says that nowadays there's no longer a mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah. We don't use a Torah scroll for learning. I've spoken about this many times. The halacha is you have to write a Sefer Torah. And the Rush says we don't have to because we have Sfarim. The other Rishonim don't say that. There's an example of what the Malbim's speaking about, because the Rush assumes that the reason that we have to write a Sefer Torah is to learn. And since now we can learn in a different way, we don't need to. Is that a reform? I remember I told you I asked Rabbi Miller from the Chris Colwell, and he wasn't sure really. Well, you know, why isn't that a reform? Well, it's not a reform, I would say, because the Rush said it. But the Malbim said that we can't determine that. But you look in the Rishonim, they're the ones that tell you that certain halachot, the reason for them are tied to the halacha. So when the reason isn't there anymore, the halacha is no longer the way it was. So the Rav can say that this is what the halacha is. You know, the halacha only applies in a certain time. That's how I see it. And Rabbi Wurzberger as well. Ben says, the Chasam Sofer Malbim sounds like magic or stories for one's grandmother. Baba Misa, I guess. Although the word Baba Misa doesn't actually come from grandmother's stories. It's, it comes from a work that it's a takeoff. The name is a takeoff of a work that was written like tales. It just happens to sound like Bubba Mises. But you're right. I'm not saying this is an actual story that it ever happened, but this is a famous tale told about the Malbim. Sometimes I've said it again and again. They don't tell these tales about us. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not, but. That's a famous story about the Malbim and the Chasam Sofer. Nikki says, when was the last time you saw wailing women and flute players at a funeral? The Talmud says that a man is required to provide them for their wife's funeral. Not just that, turning over a bed. There's all sorts of laws of Avelos that today we don't do. Just look in the Shulchan Aruch. I was learning with someone who was preparing for Smicha for the Rabbanut, and they required Avelos. So he asked me, I was his Chavrusa. And you see various halachot that we don't do. It's just not done. And, when you have a case like that, the question is always going to be, is this something we should bring back? The answer is usually the Acharonim say, they say, well, it doesn't apply anymore because of this or that. And that's exactly the Malbim's point. What they're saying is that the halacha, it's built in, so you don't need to do it anymore because our times have changed. No, Ben, the story isn't that the Chasam Sofer cursed him. It's by the Chasam Sofer saying, stay where you were. Metaphysically, the powers that be, whatever it is, they determined that the Malbim would not advance. Not that the Chasam Sofer didn't mind. He said, stay there. Again, it's a cute or a foolish story, whatever you want to say, but it's a story. But it wasn't that the Chasam Sofer was cursing him. Someone privately says the old joke. How many Orthodox rabbis do you need to change a light bulb? And change question mark? Because we don't change. But the Malbim says there is a change. And sometimes the change leads to a change in halacha. Other times you need a Sanhedrin to change it. And if you're interested, check him out in the Arta Sechaim, because he shows you for everything he says, he shows other Rishonim that disagree, and it doesn't seem to be consistency. David says he was told from a very reliable source that five pre-med students who were Kohanim approached the Rav the year before the medical school opened, asking if they could receive a heter to study medicine. And he said that in no certain terms may they enroll there or in any medical school. And today they're all accomplished physicians. Look, I know Kohanim who are doctors also. Maybe they're heterim, maybe they're not. I think we can remind ourselves of the story that I've told also on numerous occasions of Louis Ginsberg and Alexander Marx. When Alexander Marx asks if he can go in the elevator on Shabbos, and Ginsberg says it's usher, and he goes up, and then he walks up and he gets to the top, and Ginsberg's there, and he says, "But you told me it's usher," and Ginsberg says, "But I didn't ask the Shiloh." So I think we have a lot of Kohanim, excellent doctors. And once they're doctors, then they can be doctors because now they're doing pikuach nefesh. Look, they didn't ask. They didn't ask.
It was my
answer. There's a tehrim. Rabbi Chia Yaakov Weinberg says that if you're at a non... Rabbi Chia Yaakov Weinberg thought that if you you can be in a room with corpses as long as you didn't personally partake in the... in the dissections, that would be okay. We assume they're non-Jewish. And although generally Kohanim are machmir for non-Jews as well, there are plenty of Rishonim who disagreed with this. I think Shulchan Aruch says that the non-Jews are not, you're not matami with non-Jews, although we're no hate to be machmir. So Rabbi Chaim of Weinberg wanted to find a heter in cases. Rav Gorin came up with a heter. You wear this like metal piece or something that absorbs the tumah. Yes, Nikki.
I was told by a Kohanim in my classmate who was a classmate of mine, that he asked the Rav, and the Rav said, "Don't ask me."
Ah, the Rav said, "Don't." Because the Rav, we know that, and sometimes the Rav would say, "Don't ask me." That means that's my opinion. If you ask me, you'll have to abide by my psak. But there are other opinions, and that's so. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, when he would be asked a difficult abortion question, would say, "Don't ask me." But there's another great posek in Jerusalem, the Tzitz Eliezer. Go ask him. So I don't know. I'm not an expert in this. A lot has been written about it. For the one who says I should slow down, yes, I will slow down. Thank you. Oh, and Nikki says, in my last year at Einstein, at least two ham-eating Jewish students started to become frum. And after the 4 years, married fellow frum students. So that's a Kiddush Hashem. And it's very unlikely that would have happened if they were not at Einstein. So that's a beautiful story. And okay, Ben, you say being exposed to another system of law might highlight the weaknesses and strengths of the halachic system and may think it's superior overall to halacha, another's consideration. I don't know. I think that if it's taught correctly, you'll see that other systems have certain maybe advantages in certain ways, but halacha has other advantages. The Rambam says in the Morah Nevuchim, no system is perfect. There's always going to be issues by definition in the real world. So I think we should believe that our halachic system is as good as any system, even better than any system. And when it doesn't seem better, there's ways to update it, because the rabbis have the way to do it. And someone asked me also about Bar Ilan Law School, Kiryat Ono, all these places. I don't know. It's a good question about the law schools, especially in Israel. Israel's a different problem because, you know, you have religious judges. You even had a Haredi Supreme Court justice, Rav Duchovsky. He wanted to be on the Supreme Court. He's a gadol, shebegdolim, and he asked Rav Yashar said no. But you used to have Haredi. There was a Haredi on the Supreme Court who was quite close to the Chazon Ish. I forget his name now. So the whole Israeli system, or Menachem Elon wanted to argue that the Israeli system is not arkos. It's like courts from Syria, that it's a different level. And there were some poskim who wanted to have a more lenient view about the secular courts in Israel. But Rav Herzog was very opposed to this. He thought that part of the problem is that the Batei Din many times are corrupt. And not all Batei Din, certainly are Batei Din in America that are good, but it's that, and what are you going to do? How can you tell the average person to go to Beis Din? When you see these Hasidic groups, they don't even go to Beis Din. They just immediately run to the secular courts. How can you tell your local Orthodox Jew that he should go to Beis Din when you see these guys with the long beards and bekeshas? They're all fighting it out in secular courts. So, I mean, that's the real Chil Hashem. But we should be going to Beis Din because that's our system. Chaim says, unless it's recently changed, I believe REACH requires an MA as well as a BA. No, it does not require an MA. You can learn in Kollel. Maybe they give you an MA for being in Kollel, but they used to have to go to Revel graduate school. Now you can learn in Kollel, and you don't need to go to, yes, and someone said, Melch Schachter, I said, was a first Schachter's father, correct. A couple more questions. Someone says correctly, tells yeshiva, I think all yeshivas today have bechinos and levels of shiurim that one had to formally admit it to. Tells was interesting, though. Tells adopted modern ways of doing things. But I don't think in Slobokan and Volozhin, they didn't have the high schools today of these yeshivas do have bechinos. And you need bechin to get in. But once you're in, you're there. David says, non-Jewish corpse is not matame ba'ola, but maga, which is a much bigger problem in Israel. Yes. So that was written by Weinberg. This is a response to Yechiyak of Weinberg. I've never published it yet. I have enough material, I think, to publish a third volume of the writings of Rav Weinberg. Rav Weinberg wanted to argue in Chutz Aretz for a Kohen who wanted to be a doctor, assuming you didn't need, I don't know if it's feasible for a doctor not to personally engage in dissections, but he thought that we could rely on those opinions, and that he thought that was his solution to the problem. And Mel says correctly, there are many Kohenim who didn't become doctors because of that. Yes, thank you, David. Yitzhak Kister. Finally, Hadassah says Toro is a medical school. Yes, law school. I don't know that much about Toro. I'm not sure what motivates some people to raise all this money and do this for institutions that are basically for the general society. I'm not talking about the Lander College or the one for the Haredim, but Toro is such an empire now. I'm not sure really what's, okay. Well, this was great. Thank you all. We will not see each other next week, obviously. Everyone, the Kasiva V'Chasima Tova. I hope it was a very nice Rosh Hashanah for you all. And God willing, in 2 weeks, Yom Tov is on the weekends. Yeah, so 2 weeks sure. We'll pick up. Rabbi Kelman?
Yeah, a couple of points, if I may. So first of all, it's interesting, of course, the whole Cohen gene, which I'm sure most people have heard of, was discovered, of course, by a Cohen, a Toronto brilliant, brilliant doctor who went, when he went on Aliyah, I know him personally, when he went on Aliyah and he was in Shul, and I don't know if people know this part of the story, he was in Shul and a Yemenite got the Kohen Ali and he's kind of looking at him, say, hey, we're both descendants of Aaron HaKohen. How did that happen? We look so different. And that's when he started his research. This is a person who won the gold medal at the University of Toronto Medical School, went to Harvard, whatever, came in number one in Ontario and the high school of all the thousands of kids. And now he made Ali as a firm guy, a doctor, a Karis Gorecki, I'm sure if you know the name. And so it's interesting, him as a Cohen, I think it was a non-issue in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And even today, many people just didn't ask a child. They didn't even know. I think many Cohen didn't even think that.
I think you're right about that. The average Cohen, especially from the years ago.
It was just a non-issue. Whoever, what do you mean a Cohen? They wouldn't even know what you're talking about. This is like, and then if I may, on the, what you were talking about earlier, when things change and the rush and all that. So it's, Rav Schachter has a whole article because the Torah by Kitulachem at the Shira Hazot. Write down this song, the Sefer Torah, Balamda B'nai Israel, and teach it to the Jewish people. So there the Torah gives the reason. So the Torah itself gives the reason. Then it says whenever the reason becomes part of the mitzvah, either Doraita or even Dirabanan, and Rav Schachter explains, since it's right after Rosh Hashanah this year, when do the rabbis put a reason into their gzeira? Whenever they do something that's weird, like against the Torah, like the can't blow shofar, when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, maybe can't blow shofar. Torah says you blow shofar. So the rabbis had to give a reason, which is why the Mishnah Brura in the Bir Halakha asked the question, why today, when we assume there's no Rashut HaRabim, we should blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, that's on Shabbos, is in the Mishnah Brura. And he doesn't have an answer. He says it's Sarachiyun. He doesn't understand because since the reason should modify the halakha, we say we don't blow shofar because we may carry it, but who cares? Even if you carry it today, it would only be a rabbinic prohibition. So it's a fascinating subject. Things change. We were so, like you say, I don't know, brainwashed is the word, but that orthodoxy says halakha never changes. And we all know that that's not true at all. The halakha changes often.
But the Malbim says, he says that the dinim that we follow, but we don't know that, is nigzar b'minyan, like a Sanhedrin or the reason. He says that in sarach minyan latiram, he says you don't need a Sanhedrin.
Right.
All you
so
need is the
correct,
reason,
with the automatic,
a good
right.
reason. So that's going to be machokas. So when, but he gives all these examples that, where it shows, like you said. So, but, it's fascinating.
Oh, I see. David Eisen is pointing out that Rav Yisrael Ariel, Taka, they blew shofar this year on Shabbos. That's quite
Rav Yisrael Ariel, he's in Jerusalem. So they,
right, because of the Mikdash, maybe, because they used to. Yeah. I don't know what you mean, the Kohen gene does not work for Chalalim. I'm not
sure. Because let's say the Kohen marries a Zona. His son is has the gene.
I mean, I'm not an expert. No, I don't know what work. No, the Kohen gene was just a way to identify Kohenim. I don't know all the.
Right, but it wouldn't be a halal. Because if a Kohen marries a woman, say a convert,
right?
The child is no longer a Kohen, but the child has the gene.
No, that's.
So you can't rely on that.
Right, it's a patriarchal gene, as the, whatever the word is.
So you couldn't.
Father.
You couldn't say that.
I mean, it was published in Nature magazine, I think, when he first discovered it. But now the research is being developed a lot. I'm not a medical doctor. I don't know all the ins and outs. But they're doing work, and I think they are using it to be. They want to use it to prove Jewishness with Russian Jews, all kinds of different ways. The genetic field, what it opens up logically, is amazing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. Thank you for that point, by the way, those points. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. But please, God, we'll see you in 2 weeks on Chol HaMoed Sukkos. Yes. Okay. And tomorrow, of course, Dr. Sokolow and Moshe Shulman will be giving their regular Tuesday shiurim. And, Saturday night, just extra this week, of course, Rabbi Liebtag We'll be teaching Saturday night this week because Sunday morning in Israel is, you know, a couple hours before Yom Kippur. So he'll be teaching 10 o'clock Saturday night, 5 in the morning. So his commitment to Torah, as he did a couple weeks ago for Slichas, to get up early to lead. So then we have, of course, all our regular shiurim. Thursday, Chazan Malavani on the Ila, the Nusach for Ne'ila. Wednesday, Simi Peters finishing Yonah. My shiur on the Machzor on Friday. And Parshat HaShavua, Dr. Sokolow is actually giving. So he'll be speaking tomorrow in the Haftorah, and then he's giving this week's Parshat HaShavua Shir on Thursday night. So we look forward to seeing you, and for good occasions, a wonderful year, and Laila Tov, everybody. Thank you very much. Okay, Gemar Chatima Tova. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Gemar Chatima Tova.